Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The president says jobs are job one.
We're not going to rest until we've rebuilt an economy in which hard work and responsibility are rewarded and businesses are hiring again and the middle class can get its legs underneath it again.
Easier said than done. Maybe a $33 billion tax cut will help.
This is John. I'm calling from Oklahoma. Since August of 08, we've had terrible business until last month, December. We had the best December in about 3 years.
No one's against jobs, or apple pie and motherhood, for that matter. But will the cuts do the job? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning to you. Friday, January 29th. I'm Miles O'Brien in for John Hockenberry. Good morning, Celeste.
Good morning, Miles. Thanks for coming in on Friday.
Pleasure.
Let's get right to the top stories this morning. Mixed economic news coming in the past hour. First, good news. The economy grew 5.7% from October through December. That's huge in economic terms. That's the second straight quarter of the growth, and it's the fastest since 2003. The Commerce Department reports that's the strongest evidence to date that the worst recession since the 1930s ended last year. Bad news now. Wages and benefits rose last year by the smallest amount since records began nearly 30 years ago.
Today, President Obama will announce his plan to give small businesses a $5,000 tax credit for every new employee they hire this year. Lloyd Williams, owner of Clad Construction in Baltimore, joins us. Lloyd, you run a small business, just 5 employees. The president is visiting Baltimore today to launch a tax credit initiative for small business owners just like you. If you get that tax credit, would you hire some new people?
Absolutely, Miles. Let me tell you, down here in Baltimore, you know, we build a very affordable luxury townhouse. And what we found is if we provide a product for the customer, we can continue to do business. And our business has been steady. So by being steady and having employment, you know, we can now be in a position to hire new people, bring on young talent. Because it's all about the talent.
So you will be hiring?
Absolutely, absolutely. I see maybe in the very near future bringing on doubling my workforce. Right now I'm at 5. I'll go to 10.
And just to clarify, that gunfire was not in Baltimore. All right, a note of optimism from Lloyd Williams there, Clad Construction in Baltimore. Thanks for being with us.
In Afghanistan this morning, gunfire. It's a fierce gun battle that broke out in between a team of Taliban fighters who were targeting UN and government buildings and the security forces there. There were 6 or 7 militants, all reportedly wearing suicide vests. They were trapped on top of a building, and then attack helicopters were brought in to clear them out. This comes as Afghan President Hamid Karzai says he'll invite Taliban leaders to a tribal assembly to try and persuade them to lay down their weapons and support the government.
We ask all our neighbors, particularly Pakistan, to support our peace and reconciliation endeavors. We're looking forward to the international community supporting this plan of action.
The Taliban says it's considering Karzai's offer. Here at home, the White House reportedly is considering moving the trial of the chief organizer of the September 11th attacks out of Manhattan. The latest dispute was touched off when New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg complained of the costs and possible disruptions. Looking at the markets, futures are up. The Dow gets underway at 10,120. The S&P opens at 1,084. And the NASDAQ opens at 2179. We'll see how the markets react to reports that Microsoft has posted net profits of nearly $7 billion for 2009. Coming up later this hour, we're going to remember the life and legacy of J.D. Salinger. Love it or hate it, The Catcher in the Rye really influenced American culture. We're also talking about the State of the Union all week long. We want to know, what's your soundtrack for the State of the Union?
This is Carol calling from Wyandotte, Michigan, and the song that I choose would be
Trouble
by Ray LaMontagne.
Trouble, 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 trouble.
Send us a song suggestion, or better yet, sing us one. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Hello, I'm Miles O'Brien in for John Hockenberry this morning. President Obama will head to Baltimore today to roll out his plan to give small businesses some incentives to staff up. A $5,000 tax credit for every new hire, a break on Social Security taxes for employees who get a raise or more hours. The bottom line for taxpayers, about $33 billion. Money well spent? Well, we sure hope so. To help us figure out, we have two small business owners joining us this morning. Toria Blanchard, who is the owner of two Good Girls Go to Paris creperies in Detroit, Michigan, and John Brown, vice president of the Brown Furniture Company in Shawnee, Oklahoma, who called into our SpinVox line on Wednesday. Good to have you both with us. Let's begin with you, Toria. You have eight employees, including yourself.
Yes.
If you have this $5,000 tax credit, are you going to hire some more people?
Not at the moment, but it's great to have that $5,000 tax credit available. If I need to hire more people, it'd be great.
So it's not enough to have you go out and hire people. You have to have another reason to bring a person on board, I gather.
Well, my staff is all set for right now, but I think it's a great incentive. I think it's a great, $5,000 tax credit is amazing that it's put into place. So,
all right, John, you're in the furniture business. Three employees, including yourself. Are you thinking about hiring now, and would this put you over the edge?
Not really. The problem with the $5,000 tax credit is it doesn't cover the whole salary, and there's only so much to do. I'm not going to hire somebody just for a tax credit. Their salary is going to cost me a lot more than $5,000. And while I think every little bit may help a larger company or a larger employer, it certainly isn't going to help me hire a new person.
All right. Are you in the mood to give your employees a raise? And would the fact that you get a break on the Social Security taxes, would that encourage you to do that?
Well, again, it's just so small for a single employee, especially in our situation. We only have three employees. The taxes are not that much. I mean, payroll taxes are somewhere just below 7%. It would take about 15 new hires to be able to get one free employee.
So you make it up on volume kind of thing.
Right. If I don't have the sales, if I don't have people walking in the door buying furniture that I have to deliver, I don't need another employee and I can't afford another employee.
Toria, are you in the same boat in that regard? Or do you have enough customers walking in the door, first of all?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, I started a crepery in Detroit about 2 years ago, right before the recession hit. And I didn't know how it was going to go, and it worked out really well. And I have a lot of customers. However, I'm in the same boat as John. I don't think that would be enough for me to hire a new employee. I'm all set on employees right now, but it's a start. It's something.
What about the notion of would you be more inclined to give them a raise because you have a break on the Social Security taxes, for example?
Honestly, I would be more inclined to give them a raise because I have that incentive.
All right. I hope they're listening. You'll probably hear from them a little later today, won't you? Tell me in general, what did you think of the State of the Union address? Do you think the president has his focus where it should be right now?
Well, with the State of the Union address, I mean, he spoke a lot about small businesses and the economy. And at the end of his speech, he asked Washington, how long do we have to wait to make change? But I have to respectfully ask him, how long do we have to wait to get access to loans, to grow our businesses, to possibly hire more help? If small businesses are the backbone to our country, I think more needs to be done. I think as far as he mentioned the number of $30 billion we allocated to community banks, but until I see a banner that's in a community bank that says, hey, this is where the $30 billion we can have access to, we need immediate help for people that want startup for their businesses. Immediate help.
John, are you finding the same thing, that the banks just aren't lending?
Well, I have friends in Shawnee that have businesses that I've talked to in the last 24 hours, and I've asked them that same question. I had one specific business owner, restaurant owner, has about 50 employees, and he told me that the banks are not giving out money unless your credit is perfect. He's an established business, been around for about 30 years. He can get some money. We can get some money. We've been in business for over 60 years. We're fortunate. We don't need any money. We don't have much overhead.
But isn't that always the case? It's the people who don't need the money who can get it, right?
It's always the case. So it's my understanding the banks in Oklahoma are just not lending.
All right. Well, tell us a little bit about this shift now. The president seems to have moved on, at least rhetorically, from health care into the notion of jobs. Now, your businesses are so small that they wouldn't be required to participate in any legislation that was in work. But nonetheless, do you, John, think that that shift in focus is important?
Well, like he said so many times, you know, he can walk and chew gum. I don't understand why we have to quote-unquote shift. I think for some reason the people in the United States thinks there needs to be a shift. I don't understand it. I get a paycheck. I get the same paycheck. My employees get a paycheck based on sales. Meanwhile, every single year, and I'm waiting right now for that letter to come in the mail that's going to tell me my health care is going up another 10 or 20% this year. When I turn 45, it's going to go up another 10 or 15%. My wife turns 45 the same year, it goes up another 10 or 15%. So every 5 years, my health care goes up 30, 40%. 10 years ago, if I wouldn't have raised my deductible almost every year, my health care would now be more than my mortgage. People can't afford the health care. We've got to do something. I don't see why health care is not just as important as jobs. Now, I understand if you don't have a job, you need a job.
Toria, do you agree with that?
Yeah. Yes. In Detroit, I get my health care for the employees. Thank goodness I have a local county health care that I pay a third, the employees pay a third, and the county pays a third. Otherwise, I would not be able to provide health care for my employees or myself. So I couldn't afford it. Otherwise.
Toria Blanchard in Detroit, John Brown in Shawnee, Oklahoma. Thank you both. Past 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check the headlines.
In the past hour, the Commerce Department said the economy grew at a rate of 5.7% from October to December. That's the second straight quarterly gain and the fastest pace since 2003. However, the report says the growth was mostly fueled by companies refilling stockpiles. That's a trend that will quickly fade. Moving abroad, Afghan President Hamid Karzai says he'll invite Taliban leaders to a tribal assembly to persuade them to lay down their arms. Meanwhile, in an interview with The Takeaway, General David Petraeus said even as violence increases, the Afghan people are optimistic.
There is a sense in Afghanistan. Interestingly, even some polls have showed a sense of hope among the Afghan people and so on. That wasn't present before. So there is a sense of anticipation, but we have to recognize this is going to get harder before it gets easier.
You can hear that entire interview with General Petraeus at our website, thetakeaway.org.
In London, the former British Prime Minister Tony Blair is giving evidence to an official inquiry into the Iraq War. This morning, Blair defended himself against accusations the fight against Saddam Hussein was unwarranted.
The decision I took, and frankly would take again, if there was any possibility that he could develop weapons of mass destruction, we should stop him. That was my view. That was my view then. That's my view now.
Blair said the September 11th attacks convinced him to take action against Iraq. Finally, in Haiti, the U.S. Navy hospital ship Comfort is near capacity. The military has plans to build a temporary hospital on land with as many as 5,000 additional beds.
That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, who's had a good week and a bad week? We're going to talk, as we do every Friday, with our friends from The Week magazine.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
It's time for some news takeouts for you this morning, and we're going to be checking in on for whom was it a good week or a bad week. But, you know, it was both a good week and a bad week for the economy, I guess. We got good news and bad news. The economy grew 5.7% in the fourth quarter. That's stunningly high. That's the second straight quarter of growth and the fastest since 2003. Joining us now to talk about is Wall Street Journal columnist Kelly Evans. So this is good news, Kelly.
It is good news. People were expecting a pretty strong print, though, in large part because of this inventory quirk and the way the GDP is calculated. So basically, as companies were slowing the pace of destocking, that boost goes into GDP. So there's considerable volatility, and it's, you know, there. That's one reason why you might not see that 5.7% print interpreted as sort of the best thing ever, although there were some encouraging signs in the release. So, you know, if you sort of strip out the effects of inventories and trade, demand still grew at a 3.9% pace in the fourth quarter. There was strength in consumer spending, even though there was an auto-related decline from the Cash for Clunkers program. There were signs of strength elsewhere, too. And, you know, that puts the average growth in the two quarters coming out of recession at above 4%, which is considerably faster than what we saw coming out of the last couple recessions, which were jobless. So, you know, a lot of questions persist about the economy's momentum going forward, and you'll hear more of that as people say, you know, what will provide this boost as inventories wear off? Well, ideally, this is just the business cycle sort of taking hold. So the questions remain, but it was definitely an encouraging trend.
Well, you're speaking to us from the offices of the Wall Street Journal in New York, and we can hear that it's a busy day there in the background. But one thing that I hear a lot of people talking about is because this is the second straight quarter, that means we've had 6 months of growth, and regardless of what goes into making that growth, that's still a positive sign in terms of finally putting paid to the recession.
That's right. It's pretty clear that the recession ended sometime over the summer, and I'm sorry if it's noisy here.
It's quite all right. Go on with your work.
It's the newsroom. But yeah, so basically, you know, as the recession now looks to be behind us, one of the big questions right now focuses on the labor market, because the one area that's not showing the same improvement that we're seeing, for example, in manufacturing and production and some of the early indicators of activity are, first of all, of course, in the 10% unemployment rate and the loss of 85,000 jobs, private sector jobs in December, and of course also ongoing weakness in the housing market. So those two things still need to be resolved, but they don't need to be resolved in order for the recovery to happen. As you can see, it's clear that we can get some boost here while we're still figuring out these problems, and hopefully as they improve, and you know, next Friday's report could show the economy added jobs in January. You know, not enough certainly to employ the 15 million people who are waylaid right now, but certainly, you know, signs that there is a recovery taking hold.
Well, maybe people will begin to hire as they start to lose their worries about a double dip recession. But I wanted to talk to you about the news this morning out that wages and benefits paid to workers had a very modest gain in the fourth quarter. In fact, it's the smallest gain for about 30 years at least. That's not good news, is it?
Yeah, one of the reasons why there's not a lot of talk right now about what the Federal Reserve is going to do for raising interest rates, at least not, you know, outside of Wall Street, is that there's a lot of what economists call slack in the economy still. And you can see that whether you look at factories running under capacity, you can see that when you look at the number of people who are unemployed, and when those figures are so high, employers don't need to compensate in increased compensation as much as they would during normal periods of time. So, yeah, those figures are not encouraging. Obviously, you want to see incomes to help, you know, get a sustainable recovery in place. But that is also giving the Federal Reserve some breathing room, so we may not need to see interest rates rise as quickly as you would otherwise expect at a time when you have GDP growing the way that it is.
Okay, Kelly Evans, columnist for the Wall Street Journal, who deals in a business where there just never seems to be either completely positive or completely negative news. That's the economy.
And it's Friday, in case you hadn't noticed. In cooperation with our friends at The Week magazine, we're going to look back and see who had a good week, who had a bad one, in a segment we called Good Week, Bad Week. First up,
they've sent us a message that they can take whatever they want. But we will send them a message that this is our land.
Who writes that stuff? Well, it was sort of a bad time for imperialism on Pandora, but the movie Avatar broke the world box office record. So, a good week for James Cameron, king of the world, because the director beat out his arch nemesis, James Cameron, who was then the king
was
of the world.
It was a bad week for James Cameron, whose record is broken.
Hit
right?
By James Cameron. Remember Titanic? That was kind of a big hit,
right,
too. Of course, that's if you ignore the higher ticket prices for 3D and inflation. But who's counting on that?
We're counting.
Yeah.
Moving on.
Yeah.
If you like to read and you happen to live in Laredo, Texas, pretty bad week for you. Laredo's only bookstore, a Barnes & Noble owned by B. Dalton's, closed. Residents who want to buy a book now have to travel 150 miles away to San Antonio for the nearest bookstore. And the implications of this go way beyond that long car ride.
There is a statistic out there, and I'm sure it's probably accurate, that our literacy rate is at 50%. And, you know, we're looking at it, well, 50% of the population is reading. And we can bring down that number of illiteracy, you know, but without a bookstore, that makes it that much harder.
That's Laredo spokeswoman Sochit Mora. And, you know, you have to admire her optimism. It's not that we have 50% illiterate people in Laredo. It's that 50% are reading, are capable of reading.
A little bit of spin, you might
say. Ultimate half full glass. If you have nominations for who had a good week or bad week in the news, give us a call at 8778-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. You can see the full Good Week, Bad Week feature in The Week magazine. It's on newsstands and online now at theweek.com. Coming up, can Haitians find refuge with their neighbors in the Dominican Republic?
Some media leaders raised a campaign against Haitian migrants here.
We're going to talk more about this issue in just a few minutes. And we're also talking about the State of the Union this week. And we want to move on and ask you to expand your definition of the State of the Union musically. What song best describes the state of our country?
My name is Maureen. I'm from Royal Oak, Michigan. And my soundtrack for State of the Union would be Harvest.
Give us your song suggestion at 8778-MYTAKE.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, I'm Celeste Headlee, but I'm not joined by John Hockenberry this morning. He is out. I have Miles O'Brien with me this morning.
Good to be here.
Across the desk. We're going to take a look at where Haitians are trying to find refuge, and we're going to look today at the Dominican Republic, definitely their closest neighbor. More on that in a few moments. First, here's some of the news stories that we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. The United States economy grew 5.7% from October through December. That's the second straight quarter of growth and the fastest since 2003. It had grown 2% the quarter before. Economists warn that today's numbers are fueled by companies refilling depleted stockpiles, and that's a trend that will eventually fade. Also, wages and benefits rose last year by the smallest amount since records began nearly 30 years ago. Toyota says it's figured out how to fix a problem with sticking accelerator pedals and will update employees today with details. The company says engineers are working around the clock to fix the problem in 8 of its models, including the top-selling Camry. Early this week, the company recalled at least 2.5 million cars and trucks worldwide because of the problem.
President Obama will cross into unfriendly territory this morning when he speaks at a House Republican retreat in Baltimore. He's expected to talk to them about changing the tone in Washington.
Even if you disagree with me on some specific issues, all of us should be rooting for each other. All of us should be rooting for America moving forward and solving problems.
The president will also announce his plan to give small businesses a $5,000 tax credit for every new employee they hire this year. But will it work? Earlier on The Takeaway, we asked Lloyd Williams, owner of a small construction company in Baltimore, if he would hire new people if he got that tax credit.
Absolutely, absolutely. I see maybe in the very near future bringing on doubling my workforce. Right now I'm at 5, I'll go to 10.
But John Brown, a Brown Furniture Company in Shawnee, Oklahoma, had a different take.
I'm not going to hire somebody just for a tax credit. Their salary is going to cost me a lot more than $5,000.
The president will announce his proposal later this morning. And it was bad enough that President Obama lost his
filibuster proof is what you're trying to say.
You pick it up.
But he also lost it to a relative. That's some of the stories that we're following this morning. It's been 2.5 weeks since the earthquake struck Port-au-Prince in Haiti, and we're going to speak to BBC's... We spoke earlier to the BBC's Karen Allen about whether or not rescue efforts there become more organized, less chaotic.
Certainly, yes, it's falling into place, but it's still a very, very slow process. And the reason why things are slow is you have to remember that many of the government structures have completely disappeared. If you go downtown in Port-au-Prince, where I'm speaking to you from, the ministries no longer exist. The finance ministry, for example, is in tatters. The tax office has got literally tax forms strewn all over the place. So there is a real sense that the things that you would normally rely on to help organise an emergency effort like this no longer exist. There are efforts to try and shift large numbers of people who are living in makeshift camps in the centre of town out to the edges, but they don't have enough tents. They've got about 10,000 tents the UN believes it can muster, but they're expecting about a million people that they will need to shift. So what we are seeing is Haitians beginning to start take the initiative. We've seen people fashioning their own huts and tents themselves and any spare piece of land they can find. I've found people who've been redigging the foundations of their houses. And we've, of course, had that miraculous rescue over the past couple of days. You remember there was a 16-year-old girl who was dragged from the rubble of a building 15 days after the earthquake. Now, we've been hearing over the past 24 hours a little bit more about that. Doctors have said she's defied biological facts. This young woman basically was encased in concrete when the house she was in next to the university collapsed around her. She was able to survive by drinking water from a bath. She was pulled from the wreckage when neighbours heard her cries. She's now aboard a French hospital ship, and today she's expected to be reunited with her mother.
Okay, that is the BBC's Karen Allen speaking to us from Port-au-Prince in Haiti. Let's turn now to Haiti's neighbor. We're going to look at the place where Haiti's many Haitians are seeking refuge, and that is the Dominican Republic. There's a 241-mile border that separates Haiti from the Dominican Republic. Before the earthquake, there was about a million Haitians already living in the neighboring nation, many of them undocumented. Now thousands more are at least trying to cross the border in the coming months ahead. Jorge Pineda is the founder and editor of DominicanToday.com. Good morning, Jorge.
Good morning.
So how did Dominicans react in the first few hours after the earthquake?
It was probably unprecedented as far as how quickly Dominican rescuers got to Port-au-Prince. It was obviously, because of the distance, the first government to provide aid for Haiti. And the enthusiasm also was unprecedented. Dominicans just felt so, they felt so badly that we couldn't do more because, of course, we are almost as poor as Haiti. But the still, our hospitals are just overwhelmed by Haitian patients. And the Dominicans are taking it. They're doing the best they can. And because we also are familiar with tragedy, you know, this country has been hit several times by major hurricanes in the last 20 years. So we know what this feels like.
Before we kind of talk about how the relationship between the two countries has been affected by this earthquake, let's kind of remind people of the sometimes tense, definitely rocky relationship between the Dominican Republic and Haiti.
Yes, last year was quite tragic in the sense that there were several violent killings between the two countries, between the two nationals from the two countries. And it was a year to forget, obviously. And this, unfortunately, this magnitude of this tragedy will definitely make us forget the tensions that in the last 20, 30 years have heightened for the increase of undocumented Haitians coming across the border.
Well, has that relationship? We spoke to Chandra Estevez. She's a human rights lawyer at Dominican Haitian Women Movement. We asked her this question about how the relationship has changed in light of the earthquake. And Chandra blames the media for having sparked the tensions in the first place.
Some media leaders raise a campaign against Haitian migrants here. And it's really dangerous because the people are listening to the radio. The Haitians are dangerous. The Haitians are bad.
So what do you think about that? Are the Dominicans believing that Haitians are dangerous for their country?
The media cannot be blamed for this. Since we were children in school, we were taught history. The fact that as recent as 1844, it was Haiti, which dominated the Dominican Republic, and it was a violent occupation. So it isn't about beliefs, it's about history. But of course, as education improves in our country, we also realize that the Haitians aren't to blame for what happened to us 150 years ago. So this is the situation is undoubtedly improving, especially given the fact that much aid is reaching Haiti, and the many Haitians don't come across the border. Many Haitians decide to stay in Haiti, and the ones that are here are considered very hardworking. So, by and large, Americans don't feel that bad of having the 1 or so million undocumented Haitians here. And as a matter of fact, several industries depend highly on that labor, especially construction, agriculture, and even tourism.
It sure seems like the question of undocumented immigrants is a worldwide issue. Jorge Pineda is the editor of DominicanToday.com. He joined us from the Dominican Republic. Thank you so much. Coming up, The Catcher in the Rye. The author, J.D. Salinger, passed away at 91 years old. We're going to talk about his life and legacy with authors Frank Portman and Jonathan Safran Foer. They're going to join us later this hour.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Miles O'Brien, in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. Retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Lee A. Archer died this week in New York City. He was a Tuskegee Airman, considered to be the only black ace pilot. Lieutenant Colonel Archer was 90 years old. Now, Dr. Roscoe C. Brown joins us, a fellow Tuskegee Airman who served as a squadron commander and friend of Lee Archer. Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning.
Can you tell us a little bit about Lieutenant Colonel Archer and his accomplishments as an ace pilot?
Of course, his accomplishment as ace pilot means that he was a pilot who shot down 5 planes. He was the only Tuskegee Airman who've done so. He had a personality which was very aggressive, very good as a pilot. He would be able to figure out those angles from German planes and shoot them down. But more than that, he was just a wonderful person. He was a leader. People would follow him. And he was very respectful of the heritage of Tuskegee Airmen.
What did he do after his career as a Tuskegee Airman? What did he do later on?
After his career as a Tuskegee Airman, he did some really great things. He went to General Foods Company, one of the first black vice presidents of any major corporation. There he ran their minority business enterprise investment group. He helped to set up new businesses, among them Black Enterprise and Essence Magazine. He also was a leader in the community, providing support to black youth and to black organizations. In addition to Hitch, he was the governmental relations officer for the General Foods Corporation, working with the United States Air Force in terms of improving the quality of commercial flying.
You know, there were fewer than 1,000 original Tuskegee Airmen, and only about 50 or 60 of those are still with us. I'm wondering if you think we've fully captured the stories of these men who broke the color line so resoundingly in our military.
Yeah, given the fact that most people alive now don't remember segregation, and they don't know the trials and tribulations of those who overcame segregation, it's important that the story of the Tuskegee Airmen be kept alive, and it's important people like Lee Archer be recognized, just as Percy Sutton was. He was our intelligence officer, because we helped to break the barriers of the color line. We helped to make it possible for African Americans to achieve in all areas. So the Tuskegee Airmen become a synonym for progress, and a synonym for excellence, and a synonym for overcoming obstacles.
Mr. Archer, and you, I think, was among the group of Tuskegee Airmen invited to attend Barack Obama's inauguration in 2009.
As a matter of fact, the Obama people invited all of the living Tuskegee Airmen to come to the inauguration because they felt that what we did was to help open the door for people like Obama. So it was a very, very proud day for all of us.
And a really update to history to see you there standing next to the first African-American president.
And that's really true. And, of course, we received a Congressional Gold Medal in 2007, and that, too, was an outstanding recognition of our responsibilities and our tributes to our contributions, rather, to our great country. So, therefore, the Tuskegee Airmen represent progress. They represent a symbol of excellence. And Lee Archer was one of the top Tuskegee Airmen. He was our ace.
Okay, Dr. Roscoe C. Brown, a Tuskegee Airman who served as a squadron commander along with Lee Archer, retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Lee Archer, the only black ace pilot and a Tuskegee Airman.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with Miles O'Brien on a great Friday. John Hockenberry's away today, but we'll return on Monday. Coming up, we're going to remember the life of the late author J.D. Salinger, who died at the age of 91 and whose book was a major cultural milestone in the United States. That's coming up. We've also been talking about the State of the Union all week long, and we want to know, what do you think is the soundtrack for the State of our Union? What song best describes where the country is right now? Send us your suggestion, or you can sing it at 8778. My take. Let's check on the leading headlines right now at 47 minutes after the hour. The Commerce Department said the economy grew at a rate of 5.7% from October to December. That's the second straight quarterly gain and the fastest pace since 2003. But the report says the growth was mostly fueled by companies refilling stockpiles, and it is a trend that will quickly fade. Also, wages and benefits rose last year by the smallest amount since records began nearly three decades ago. In London, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says the international community is discussing consequences for Iran if it continues its nuclear program.
Our efforts to apply pressure on Iran are not meant to punish the Iranian people. They are meant to change the approach that the Iranian government has taken toward its nuclear program.
At home, the Senate has voted to strengthen sanctions against Iran. They'll also impose new ones aimed at its gasoline supplies.
Top military advisors will hold a meeting about the plan to allow gays to serve openly in the military. Here's the Army Chief of Staff, General George Casey.
President Obama has been very clear with Secretary Gates and Admiral Mullen that he's committed to changing the law.
The meeting is scheduled for Tuesday. Meanwhile, President Obama is calling on Congress to pass a law extending benefits to same-sex partners. The White House is considering moving the trial of the chief organizer of the 9/11 attacks out of Manhattan. The latest dispute was touched off when New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg complained of costs and possible disruptions. Finally, about 48 million viewers tuned in for President Bush's first State of the Union address. That's 7% less than former President George W. Bush garnered in his first address, for those of you keeping score at home. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Teenaged, angst-ridden rebels everywhere lost the man who created their icon, J.D. Salinger, author of The Catcher in the Rye, died at the age of 91. His novel was first published in 1951 when he was 32 years old. It embodied the teenage angst through its protagonist, Holden Caulfield. He was a rebel with a cause, and that was to escape the world of phonies. Joining us now are two people who kind of embody the difference of opinion on the book. Jonathan Safran Foer, author of Everything is Illuminated and Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. We have another author, Frank Portman, who is the author of King Dork and Andromeda Klein. Welcome to both of you.
Hello.
Hey there.
Okay, so love it or hate it, that's kind of my theory about Catcher in the Rye. Let's start with you, Jonathan Safran Foer. You list the J.D. Salinger's book as an inspiration to you. In what way did it inspire you?
Well, a lot of things I hate inspire me too, right?
Are you saying you hate it?
No, I would just say those aren't the only two choices. I think that, he might be the only author that every single American has read. So it would be hard to, overstate how important he was. But I think he was important not only because of his books, but because of not just the writing in his books, but how the books influenced the culture and the whole notion of saying no, of resisting, of standing apart. It's something that there's a line of it in American literature and in American culture. The line might have ended about a decade or two ago, but he's probably the most important figure in that line. And it inspired a lot of people to do a lot of things. It inspired a lot of writers to become writers, not because they wanted to write like him, but because they wanted to stand apart.
You know, and it's funny that, I don't think there's any argument over how significant this book is, what a milestone it was, and how it's influenced not just literature, but American culture as well. And as you say, sometimes things that we really don't like inspire us to great heights as well. Frank Portman, you're perhaps an example of that. You wrote this novel, King Dork, and you wrote about a character who hated The Catcher in the Rye, but
right.
was
mean,
defined
my,
by it.
See, my character, you know, that sort of is one of the things that defines him. This is he despises the character Holden Caulfield in the book, The Catcher in the Rye. And the reason that I decided to do that was because anytime anyone writes about a teenager, the figure of Holden Caulfield in The Catcher in the Rye is always there, unspoken, and whether it's referred to in the text or not. And I decided that the way to handle that situation was just to just kind of go to town on and have fun with trying to undermine the usual take on what it means. I think I agree with what Jonathan said about how there's more than two answers to that question. I mean, it's a complicated thing. But I think one of the interesting things that's going on with the Catcher in the Rye now is that the experience of reading it that led to its reputation and that got everybody all excited about it back in the 50s, those conditions don't exist anymore at all. In fact, they're kind of reversed now. So there was a time when reading The Catcher in the Rye was this rebellious act, and the content of it sort of it was congruent with the experience of reading it. Now it's the opposite. Now you get like patted on the head if you're a kid. You say, Catcher in the Rye is my favorite book, and all your teachers give you awards and medals, and your parents are smiling at you. And there's a sort of a strange situation.
I think it's fascinating. I sense some sarcasm there, Frank Portman. I sense some sarcasm in that remark, Frank Portman. Jonathan, tell me, is this the quintessential teenage novel? Does all other novels, even written by adults like this one was, do they all have to kind of channel this to a certain extent?
Well, I mean, that might have been true until fairly recently. It's hard to now pretend that it has more importance for young people than Harry Potter or this Twilight stuff. I don't know. You know, time will tell. I think that a lot of young people read it now and can't quite believe that it was ever controversial and find it a little bit kitschy almost. You know, like he said crap and that's supposed to make me blush. The problem is, you know, the blessing and the problem for kids now is they have access to everything. It's almost impossible to imagine anything being taboo anymore. And because of that, it's hard to imagine how a young person could, as I was saying at the beginning, stand apart. You know, so much of The Catcher in the Rye, what the character goes through and also the experience of reading it is you know, confronting one's identity and how it can be alienating to oneself and to others. And, you know, these are problems that it's not a coincidence that high school students respond so strongly to the book. It's because, you know, I can't imagine a high school student who doesn't confront these questions and problems of identity. And it'll be interesting to see how all of that changes now that, you know, in response to Facebook and Twitter and being constantly connected and the constant emphasis and requirement to be connected all the time, how it is that one will even seek, you know, apartness.
Wow. Let me ask you about that, Frank Portman. Do you think, number one, let's ask you, is it fair that Catcher in the Rye defines J.D. Salinger at this point? He just passed away, and pretty much The Catcher in the Rye is one of the only things that most people remember him for. Is that fair?
Well, I mean, it certainly had a huge impact on the culture, so, you know, if it's fair to him that's what he's remembered for, I think so. I think that it is sort of, maybe where it's unfair is that it gets categorized as by people as sort of the be-all and end-all, summing up the teenage experience, which is a lot more varied than that. Sort of, I would say, even though it's a great book, a sort of stilted version of it that is presented in The Catcher in the Rye. So I mean, there's more to be said certainly about teenagehood than just what's found in that book.
Well, to be fair to J.D. Salinger, he never claimed that he wrote the quintessential teenage novel. That's Frank Portman, author of Andromeda, Klein, and King Dork, and Jonathan Safran Foer, author of Everything is Illuminated, also Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. Thanks to both of you.
If you missed anything, we're always here on The Takeaway. Take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org.
And with the Super Bowl next weekend, you're probably not going, but as your congressman, we're teaming up with ProPublica to find out which particular what politicians are going to the big game and how they got their tickets. We want your help in being a reporter for this. So join this project by going to our website, thetakeaway.org. And speaking of politics, we're talking about the State of the Union all week long. We want to know, what's the soundtrack for the State of the Union? What song describes our country right now?
Hi, my name is Kevin from Brooklyn. The song I would choose to describe the administration is a church song, I believe, by the James Cleveland Choir. I don't feel no ways tired. It goes something like, I don't feel no ways tired.
And kind of in tune there. Thanks so much. Send us your song suggestion at 8778-MYTAKE or post it at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
My choice was The Thrill Is Gone, B.B. King. I'm Miles O'Brien, in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Nobody told me that the road would be.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.